I am Pranessa Seal, the founder and CEO of The Balm in Gilead. The Balm in Gilead is a not-for-profit, non-governmental organization with an international mission to mobilize and educate churches throughout the African diaspora to address HIV. African people, African Americans here in the United States, the Caribbean, and our brothers and sisters living on the mother continent of Africa are disproportionately affected by HIV. One in every 50 black men here in the United States infected with HIV. One in every 160 black women living in the United States infected with HIV. The Caribbean island, the second highest rate of HIV infection in the world, second only to the continent of Africa. Over 20 million Africans infected with HIV on the mother continent. African people, we must do everything that we can to stop the spread of HIV. You have a role to play. Our churches have a role to play. Educate your children. Talk to the people on your job. Let's make every church a center for AIDS education. The video you are about to see is a part of a historical series of historical sermons by renowned pastors in the United States addressing HIV. Thank you for your work in stopping the spread of HIV, and thank you for supporting The Balm in Gilead.
Thank you. Dr. Seal. Our CEO and our executive and our leader and our friend. And to all of you who are of the household of faith, those of you who have come to this special place at this special time, I greet you today in the name of the Lord Christ. It is a name that is above every name. And one day at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. How many of you know he's Lord today? Come on, give God the praise because he's Lord. I am delighted to have the privilege to come again, as has already been mentioned, to have an opportunity to share in this continuing work of compassion and love. It is my privilege to come today to stand as a representative of the AIDS ministry of the Metropolitan Church, where for more years than I can count, we have been trying to help those who deserve care and who deserve love and who deserve our attention. I'm grateful for this privilege because it gives me an opportunity to salute you and to acknowledge the work of your hands and to know what great work God is doing through you and to acknowledge the great work that God is yet about to do because of the things which you have learned and the things which you've shared in this place. I do come mindful of the fact that I stand on sacred soil. This is the soil of our forefathers and our foremothers. One cannot stand on this soil without acknowledging Booker T. Washington and without acknowledging George Washington Carver. And to acknowledge that we are where we are, we stand where we stand because of those, our mothers and our fathers, who have blazed the trail and made the way and suffered and sacrificed on the lynching trees that surround this soil. And I thank God for the privilege of being in this place. I want to lift today for the next few moments a scripture that is clearly central to your gathering and which is foundational to your organization. In the book of Jeremiah, the 8th chapter, the 21st and the 22nd verses. For the hurt of the daughter of my people am I hurt. I am black. Astonishment hath taken hold on me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? I want to talk this morning on the theme, when prophets cry. When prophets cry. At some time during the process of his maturation, every young lad receives this word of advice. Big boys don't cry. There is, we are told, something unmanly about men who are prone to weep. Maturity, we are told, requires that a man retain control over his emotions, mask his feelings, and squelch his innermost insecurities. Grow up means that one no longer responds to life's difficulties through tears. Rather, one learns how to take it, how to roll with the punches, how to keep a stiff upper lip, and how to stand your ground. And no matter what circumstances come, no matter what circumstances or difficulties appear, no matter how hard life seems to treat you, everybody knows that big boys don't cry. I, for one, do not understand how we have come to such a dubious and questionable conclusion. Surely those of us who are encased in mortal flesh understand that, if nothing else, there are circumstances and structures in this life that are designed to make you cry. When your fondest dreams have been deferred, when the hope of your life lies at your feet in ashes, burned into nothingness by the bitter cruelties of chance and fate, and when everything you have given your life to is gone, it will make you cry. When your home life is a shambles, when your marriage is a mess, when there is no joy in the place where you live, when your children are strung out on cocaine or incarcerated in some penitentiary, when the one you love does not love you back, when your money is always insufficient to your need and there are always more bills than you can pay, it will make you cry. When time robs you of the vitality of your youth, your limbs are no longer agile, your skin no longer supple, when your hair glistens with unmelting snow, and when you discover that the vigor you once enjoyed is gone, you will cry. When the work of your hands never seems to end, when you are required to work from can't see in the morning until can't see at night, when the pay you receive is not equivalent to the labor you offer, and when it appears that no one ever has a word of appreciation for the work you give, when you always make time for somebody else's problems, but nobody ever has time for yours, it will make you cry. Don't tell me that big boys don't cry. I've been there, done that. When sickness comes upon your life like a thief in the night, when the test always turns out to be the thing you did not want to hear, when the biopsy is more than you can handle, when the T-cells are not what they ought to be, when the chemotherapy and the radiation rob you of your strength and your dignity, when doctors have no answers for the questions, and when the medicine in your cabinet never seems to take the pain away, sometime, way over in a midnight hour, you will cry. Ah, but if that is the only reason for my tears, then my tears are self-serving. If that is the only reason for my crying, then I am crying for myself. If the outrageous fortunes, the slings and the arrows, the unfortunate exigencies of life are the only reason for my tears, then I am engaged in my own personal pity party, to which no one else is invited and about which no one else surely cares. Let me assure you, however, that I would not be dismissive of tears under any circumstance. But the tears that have the greatest meaning, the tears that evoke the greatest empathy, are not the tears I shed for myself, but the tears I shed for someone else. When I cry for someone else, I stand in another's shoes and experience another's pain. When I cry for someone else, I am able, by some means of transference, to feel the weight of life's crushing defeats. I am able to sense the torn tissue of a broken and bleeding heart. I am able, as it were, to feel the hurt and taste the bitter cup that life has forced them to drink. When I cry for someone else, I am able to see beyond myself. I am able to stand with someone else in a vulnerability I have never known. I am able to come to the point of shared suffering and mutual misery. When I cry for someone else, I am able to empathize with someone else who lives in a house of pain I have never visited. I am able to realize that these little aches and pains of mine are not to be compared with the knots and bruises of others. Ah, but maybe I'm really not speaking to your issue today. Come here, let me ask you a question, preacher. Have you ever cried for someone else? Have you ever been able to cry not because of what happened to you,
but because of what happened to someone else? Have you ever been able to stand in somebody else's body and see with their eyes and hear with their ears? Have you ever cried because you felt the sting of another's shame? Have you ever cried because the one you loved knew what was right but could not do what was right? Have you ever cried because of someone who tried to wash away their troubles in a bottle and there was nothing you could say to turn them around? Have you ever cried for someone else whose pain was so deep that you couldn't stand it? Have you ever cried because of a child that was headed in the wrong direction down a path of destruction and there was nothing you could do or say that could turn them around? Have you ever cried because of a prodigal son or a prodigal daughter that lived in your house and wound up living with pigs and there was nothing you could do about it? Hard while I'm on my way. Let me not leave you with the wrong impression that religious folk don't cry. Maybe big boys don't cry. But if you are a child of God, you will cry sometimes. Just because you have a relationship with the living God does not mean you will not cry. Just because you have given your life to him in repentance, you are convinced that you have been regenerated and born again, does not mean that you are immune from, that you are exempt from, or that you are vaccinated from those things that will make you cry. Just because you have faith, even if you have faith that is sufficient to move mountains, does not mean that your eyes will never wash with briny tears. And whether you know it or not, even though joy comes in the morning, weeping still endures through the night. In fact, when I look at this book, it says here that tears are a way of life. Quite often it does not say so directly, but I believe the full implication of this word is that there are moments when tears are the natural consequence of this adventure we call life. May I call the roll here? I believe that before Abraham took Isaac to the mountain with knife in hand and with wood for fire, I believe that Abraham cried and Sarah was somewhere in the bushes bathed down in tears. When David experienced the loss of his child through Bathsheba, I believe that a guilty David cried. I believe that when Ruth lost her husbands and her sons and was left to live her life alone, there's no doubt in my mind that Ruth cried. I believe that Naaman, who was captain of the armies of Syria, when Naaman looked at himself in the morning and discovered that something had come upon his flesh, I believe that above all else, Naaman cried. Before the woman with an issue of blood touched the hem of his garment, I bet she spent some lonely nights when the pain was more than she could bear, and she cried. Paul was an apostle, but they beat him 40 times. Save one, and threw him in jail with Silas. And I believe one night in jail, Paul cried. And even Jesus stood outside the door to Lazarus' house. And when they told him his friend was dead, Jesus wept. And if you'll let me get personal about this thing, you don't mind. I'm going to get personal about this thing here in a minute. There are times when the pastor cries. You did tell me there were some preachers down here somewhere. There are times when the pastor cries. In fact, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with a pastor who will not cry. Can I get a witness in here? I pity the pastor who has stood in sick rooms and been unaffected by the hurt. I pity the pastor who has stood in courtrooms and been unable to feel compassion. I pity the pastor who has stood in graveyards and yet is unable to feel any loss or grief. I pity the pastor who has stood at the bed where AIDS has done its work and been unaffected or unstaggered by death's unnecessary work. I pity the pastor who has stood in the house of suffering and pain and yet unable to cry a sympathizing tear. Maybe it is true that big boys don't cry. But every once in a while, If there is a compassionate bone in your body, I declare you will cry. It is then this weeping motif. It is to this motif that my heart is turned in this hour. Here is a text that tells me everything I need to know about Jeremiah. His hometown is Anathoth, and that's really insignificant. That he comes from the land of the Benjaminites is interesting, but in this connection, it's unimportant. I may want to know something of his family and his parents or his educational rearing, but not now. All I need to know about Jeremiah is bound up in this little text at the close of the 8th chapter of his writing. For the daughter of my people, I am hurt, I am black, astonishment hath taken hold on me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Understand what is at work here. One cannot come to an understanding of these words apart from the context that shapes them. Something in Jeremiah's view, something was radically wrong with the nation. It was as though some sickness, some malady, some incurable disease had overtaken the nation, and there appeared to be no cure in sight. Jeremiah understood that in order to provide a prognosis, one must first make a reliable diagnosis. And every time he turned around, it appeared that something else had gone wrong down within the fiber of the nation. May I make a diagnosis today? First of all, Judah's problem was political. Rather than rely on God as her first line of defense, the nation chose to make alliances with Assyria and then with Egypt. When Judah should have been relying on God, she was relying on diplomatic skills. She wanted to try her hand at power politics. When Judah should have been at prayer and praise, she was off playing politics with neighboring nations. Second of all, Judah's problem was spiritual. God had promised to protect Israel. God had promised to provide for Judah. God had promised that this nation, a nation that was no nation, this people, a nation that were not a people, would be his people and they would be his God. But now in her rush to play power politics, in her rush to rub shoulders with the kings of the earth, in her rush to secure her borders by means of political gamesmanship, Judah had become a prostitute. As a nation, she had played the harlot with many lovers. So depraved was Judah, in fact, that she plied her wares, says Jeremiah, under every green tree. Her problem was spiritual. Third of all, Israel's problem was one of spiritual deception. A generation of prophets, preachers, had grown up in Egypt, in Israel, in Judah, that lied and did not tell the truth. Everywhere they turned, there was a preacher preaching. But what was being preached was not the word of God. Everywhere they turned, there was a prophet on every corner. But everybody that claims to be a prophet is not necessarily a prophet. Preachers and prophets were crying out, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Preachers and prophets crying out that salvation was in the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Preachers had on robes, but they did not speak the word of the Lord. Preachers had their collars turned around, but they had not turned their lives around. But Jeremiah said, what you're listening to is nothing but lying words. They had made the temple a den of thieves. It got so bad that God said, I'm going to cast you out of my sight. If you pray, if you lift up a cry, even if you make intercession to me, I will not hear you. You are doing nothing but deceiving yourselves. And now it seemed like there was no way out of her dilemma. Read the 7th chapter of Jeremiah before you read the 8th chapter. And there you will discover that God had reached the point where the pain in the city would be so great and there would be no joy in the city. God says, in the streets of Jerusalem, the voice of mirth, the voice of gladness, and the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride will no longer be heard, for the land shall be desolate. Not only that, things will become so bad for the nation that even the bones of the kings of Judah will be taken out of their graves and spread and bleached before the sun. And that's why Jeremiah cries. That's why Jeremiah has earned the title, the weeping prophet. That's why one writer suggested that Jeremiah climbs to the mountain of primal pain. The sickness is both endemic and epidemic. The disease has taken hold of mind and body. The pain, excruciating pain, is evident on every face. There is a malignancy that goes to the very root of our being. There is no single cure because there is no single cause. That's why Jeremiah speaks in the first person of pain. Did you hear what he said? For the hurt of the daughter of my people, am I hurt? I am black. Astonishment hath taken a hold on me. Here is a prophet who cries. There's something strange afoot when prophets cry. Why does the prophet cry? I hear Jeremiah saying, because you cry, I cry. Because you hurt, I hurt. I'm not in this preacher thing as a casual observer. I'm not in this prophet business because I need a 9-to-5 job. I'm not apart from it. I'm down in it. Your pain is my pain. Your sickness is my sickness. Your disease is my disease. Jeremiah understood that in this life, there are some things that will make you cry. It is then in the context of prophetic tears that Jeremiah raises the question of healing. Jeremiah raises the question of that which can bring healing collectively and healing personally in the life of the nation. Listen, there is no point in the sickness if healing is available. It took me a long time to get here, but I just wanted to tell you that there is no point in the sickness if the remedy is already available. And Jeremiah understood that medical science had discovered such a cure in the region known as Gilead. The medical news had reported that there was a balm in Gilead, a healing supply for the physicians of the Eastern world. A balm in Gilead that had medicinal properties that could turn sickness into health. A balm in Gilead that brought mercy where there had been misery. A balm in Gilead where a quality of life could be restored. A balm in Gilead that brings wholeness where once there had been brokenness. A balm in Gilead that soothes the body and heals the hurt and takes the pain away. But Dr. Bailey, that's what causes Jeremiah to raise his question. That's what causes Jeremiah to raise his rhetorical question. He who raises the question also has the answer. Jeremiah knows beyond the shadow of a doubt that there is a bomb. And yet he raises the question, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? And the answer is yes. Yes, there is a balm, but there ought to be a prophet there. There ought to be a priest there. There ought to be a physician there. There ought to be a teacher there. There ought to be a healer there. There is a balm, but there ought to be somebody there that knows what to do with it. May I preach just for a minute here today? I know this is strange, but y'all just bear with me. There ought to be somebody there that knows how to explain it to you. There ought to be somebody there that knows how to direct you through the healing process. There ought to be somebody there that knows that God's name is Jehovah Rapha, that God is a healer. There ought to be somebody there that knows that God is in the business of shutting hospitals and putting patients out. There ought to be somebody there that knows that God does not intend for you to remain in your sickly condition. There ought to be somebody there that has a supply of divine ointment that can touch you at the point of your deepest need. Listen. This is why Jeremiah's question is important. Jeremiah says that if there is a balm in Gilead,
If there is a healer there, then something ought to be different. This is the word you didn't want to hear. But Jeremiah raises the question, if there is a balm in Gilead, why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? In other words, Jeremiah raises the question of efficacy. With everything you have and with everything you're doing in the name of your religion, then why is it that it appears your religion doesn't seem to be doing any good? With all of the resources that God has placed at your disposal, something ought to be different. Can I preach in here this morning? Somebody help me in here. Did you hear Jeremiah say, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved? With all these prophets and preachers running around here, somebody ought to be saved. With all of these prayers praying, and these singers singing, and these shouters shouting, and these dancers dancing, and these speakers in tongues speaking, look to me like something ought to be different. With all of these churches churching, the pain of poverty should be gone. The homelessness should be a thing of the past. Homes ought to be whole. Children ought to be under control. The lost should be found. Reprobates should be redeemed. The sickness should be cured. And sinners ought to be saved. I don't mean to be irreverent in here, but look like with all these folk laying on of hands, all these folk anointing with oil and binding Satan and breaking yokes, look to me like there ought to be a difference in somebody's life. Evidently, there's a problem. Tell your neighbor, evidently there's a problem. Dr. Bailey, we're going to make a leap right now. We're going on to deal with the critical question. There is a problem. This is the problem. What Judah was counting on to save her could not save her. Judah thought that her salvation was in political alliance. Or in this modern day Judah, that her salvation was in technology, or in science, or in medical discovery. But she was taking the wrong medicine. You know what it is to take the wrong medicine. And therefore she's not cured. Listen, I'm going to tell you something very simple, and I'm ashamed to tell you because it's so simple. This is not erudite. This is not scholarly. But I'm going to tell you anyhow. Listen, if you have cancer, aspirin won't help you. If you have high blood pressure, Advil won't do you any good. If you have cataracts, ain't no need in taking Tylenol.
Plain and simple. I mean, that's down there where everybody can eat, ain't it? I mean, I ain't up there where the giraffes are. I'm down there where everybody can eat. You need the right prescription that will heal your disease. And I came to tell you today that there is a balm in Gilead. But it may not be the balm you think. Listen, I'm going to hurry on and bring this matter to a close. There is a balm in Gilead. But there are three things you need to understand about this balm. First thing that the nation needed to understand was that the balm she needed was not typical for her region. When Judah wanted balm, they discovered it was not native to Palestine. It was grown in Arabia, and therefore it had to be imported. The balm you are looking for does not come from your region. The balm you're looking for does not come from your coast. The balm you're looking for is not in Alabama. It's not in Atlanta. It's not in Washington, D.C. The balm you're looking for has to be imported from another country. It's got to come all the way from the throne of the Ancient of Days. The balm you're looking for must come from the farthest reaches of the eternity, from the mystery of the seat of the Godhead. The balm you're looking for has to come from that place before time began to run, before the morning stars sang together, or the sun began to shine. And did I tell you? He came down from another country. He came down to a little town called Bethlehem. He came down, and they wrapped him in swaddling clothes and placed him tenderly in a manger. He came down here, and when he arrived, they tell me that shepherds forgot their sheep and wise men hushed their mouths and put on traveling shoes. He came down here and took up residence in a carpenter shop. He came down here through 42 generations. He came down here because this balm needs must come from another country. But that's not all. The balm you're looking for does not come from some majestic tree. The balm in Gilead to which Jeremiah refers and of which you celebrate is really nothing more than a scrawny, scraggly bush. The balm does not come from some majestic fir in Vermont. It does not come from some redwood of California. It does not come from some grand magnolia of Georgia or Alabama. It does not come from some weeping willow of Louisiana. It's just a shrub. Just a little bush. I don't know what you call it. I looked it up before I came down here. I said, this is the balm in Gilead. I want to look it up. I want to do a little homework. I want to see what this is. I looked it up, and even the scholars are divided on the issue. Some say it was the Camphora obopalsum, or the Camphora africana, or the African bedellum, or the Melissa officinalis, or the Scythium terebinthium, or more commonly known as the turpentine tree. But no matter what you call it, it was a shrub. It was nothing more than an ugly shrub. And that's why this balm, this healing balm, this living balm, is not something that is pretty. It is not something that is attractive. In fact, this balm is not something. It is someone. And I thought I'd tell you today that the shrub is not attractive. In fact, Isaiah said, he shall grow up before him as a tender plant
and as a roots out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness that we should desire him. But when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. But that's what the world sees. That's what the world sees. But when I see him, he's fairer than 10,000. When I see him, he's altogether lovely. When I see him, he's the lovely chief of all my joys. When I see him, he's sweeter than honey or the honeycomb. When I see him, he's the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valley, the bright and morning star. I keep on telling you that the balm had to come from another country. The balm came from a bush that was not attractive. And I'm going to my seat when I tell you that this balm, Jeremiah's balm, did not have leaves or bark that had any healing substance in them. Now, I was born in Louisiana. And a lot of Louisiana still left in me. And when we used to get sick, my grandmama would go outside. Y'all don't know what I'm talking about, y'all. Too young to know what I'm talking about. I'm the only gray hair in here, look like. Well, Clairol is in here. I know Clairol is in here. They take the leaves from a tree, make a poultice out of it. Then they take the bark of the tree. You know, Mama used to give us some sassafras tea. Anybody here know anything about sassafras tea? Mama said it was good for what ails you. But this balm that Jeremiah speaks of did not come from the leaf of a tree. This balm did not come from the bark of a tree. In order to get to the balm, it had to cut the tree. And the tree had a gummy substance, liquid, a flowing fluid that came out of the tree that had power. I said it had power. It had power for the healing of the malady. Can I get a witness here? Well, that's why Jesus came. But don't forget that when he came, he taught us. But his teaching could not heal us. When he came, he taught us. But his teaching could only help us. It could not heal us. He healed the sick. But it could not heal everybody. In order for the balm to work, he had to make his way to a hill called Calvary. And there they cut him. They drove nails in his hands. They placed a crown of thorns on his head. They cut him. They ran him through with a spear in his side. And they tell me that what happened was that when they cut him, there was a substance. When they cut him, there was a liquid. When they cut him, there was a fluid that came out of him on my behalf. What came out of him had redemption for me. What came out of him
had mercy for me. What came out of him had healing for me. What broke him apart put me together.
And I just thought I'd tell you today that it's available to you. I thought I'd tell you it's available to you. Old folk in Alabama used to sing, the blood's done signs. My name. Does anybody here know that the blood will sign your name? And I thought I'd tell you today that there is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's vein, and sinners plunge beneath that flood, lose all their guilty stain. The dying thief rejoices to see that fountain in his day, and there may I, for vile as he, wash all my sins away. There is power, yeah. In case you hadn't been there, somebody said, come to this fountain. So rich and so sweet. Cast thy poor soul at the Savior's feet. Plunge in. Plunge in today. And be made complete. And you'll sing glory. Glory to his name. There is a fountain filled with blood. I came here today only for the purpose of telling you that if you cry, it's okay. If you cry, the God I serve understands your tears. And in fact, he promised to wipe every tear from your eye. And listen, children, I don't come here with any pretense and no okey-doke with me. This is too serious to play games. I have no power to heal, but I know someone who does. I'm not anointed to heal. I'm anointed to take you to the place where healing can occur. I don't have healing in my hands, but I can take you down to Bethesda where there's troubling in the water. I can take you out by Calvary where there's a fountain opened up in Israel. And there's somebody here who needs to know today that ultimate healing is available to you He says, I am come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. There is healing available for you. I don't care what the report says. There is healing available for you. I don't care what the physician says. There is healing available for you. Tell your neighbor, there's healing available for you. I don't care. If others have walked away, there is healing that's available for you. Somebody needs prayer right now. So as we come to the close of this conference, and it could be that it's not you, but it's somebody else. You're not crying for yourself today. You're crying for somebody else. You're not here because of your condition. You're here because of somebody else's condition. You're not here because of something going wrong with you, but you're here because there's something wrong in your neighborhood. There's something wrong in your city. There's something wrong in your church. And that's what makes you cry. But I came to tell you today that there is healing that is available for you. Anybody here know I'm telling the truth? Does anybody here know I'm telling the truth? That there is healing that is available for you. If he can heal the lepers at the gate, if he can heal Naaman so that his skin comes forth like baby's skin, if he can heal the woman with an issue of blood, if he can heal blind Bartimaeus, if he can heal the man with a withered hand, if he can heal Jairus' daughter, if he can heal the widow of Nain's son, if he can heal that boy at the foot of the mountain, then I'm here to tell you there's healing available for you. Come on, let's gather around this little altar right here. We'll make this conference center into a church.